Welcome. So my name is Rachel McCarthy, and I am at Cornell University, and I work on two main programs, the First Detector program and the Sentinel Plant Network, which is a First Detector program of sorts. So just to give you a little bit of background, if you have not heard about the First Detector program, it's a program that was started by the National Plant Diagnostic Network, which that organization was formed in 2002. In response to enhance our agricultural and natural plant resources. And the First Detector program started, was started by the National Plant Diagnostic Network. And it is a early detection volunteer program. And the focus is on high consequence plant pests and pathogens. We also mention weeds, but most of our people are working with insects or arthropods and plant pathogens. The NPDN also coined this term First Detector, which is now becoming, you know, somewhat more of a term used like Master Gardener. So First Detectors are people who, you know, work with plants. Originally, these people maybe were extension educators. The original concept behind the First Detector program was that it was a train-the-trainer program where we would develop these materials and go out and conduct face-to-face workshops to teach extension educators and other people in those positions how to train people to look for and report or submit samples on these high-consequence pests. So to take the definition a little bit further, they're individuals who might notice something unusual. We focus on introductions, not necessarily new to the U.S., but new to a particular area. And those people who have also gotten training with our program. And as I mentioned, you know, just to give you an idea of who some of these people are who we're calling First Detectors, really it's anybody that's working in early detection programming. A lot of times people use our curriculum through their Master Gardener programs. You know, horticulture people, growers was one of the original big focus groups when we started the program. Landscapers and arborists attend our programs. Homeowners, foresters, you know, really anybody. Just to give you a little overview of some of the stuff that we've done since we started, it was a traditional focus in the beginning. We launched the program in 2003, and at that time, in our database, we have recorded over 17,000 people who have participated in First Detector training across the country. I was at a talk a couple days ago, and person stood up and said that number is very impressive, which is nice that that's impressive, but that number represents just a fraction because those are only instructors who actually took that content of that training and uploaded into our database. So that's something I can pull a report on. There's a lot of other people doing First Detector training, and they're not actually reporting it back to us that they've conducted that training. But what we can say is that we've conducted training in all 50 states and U.S. territories. In 2009, the First Detector program launched our online training program. And in our database right now, we have close to 5,000 people who are registered users of that information. So what that information does, if any of you are familiar with online training, it allows an individual to create an account and interact with our biosecurity course from their home computer at their own pace and complete those modules. Once they've completed the crop biosecurity course, which is 6 modules, they're able to print out their own certificate of completion and say that they're a registered First Detector. Just to give you an example of another way, a group of people who are using or interacting with the First Detector program, in 2010, a partner program with the National Plant Diagnostic Network and the American Public Gardens Association together came together with funding from USDA APHIS and USDA NIFA to form a Sentinel Plant Network. And what the Sentinel Plant Network is essentially a First Detector program where we're focusing on the public garden community, and we do professional development workshops for individuals. Usually they're frontline horticulture people or IPM people working at public gardens. We teach them about invasive or, you know, even exotic pests that are not known to be in this country right now, how to improve their scouting skills. We've developed a curriculum for them to use within their own programming, and then they're further promoting the First Detector program with their public and their volunteers and visitors. So the model is, you know, for public gardens as first detectors and as first detector educators. And right now, since, so we launched, or we had our, we launched in 2010, we had our first workshop in 2011. And since then, I think we're close to 260 public gardens across North America. So we have quite a few public gardens who participate in the program in Canada and in Mexico and Costa Rica. So how are you able to engage with the First Detector program and our resources? So our website can be found at firstdetector.org, and that is the home for all of our training information and you know, resources, as well as you know, downloadable resources and training content. The way we've laid out the website now, which we just relaunched or launched a new website this spring, the content is laid out for depending on what the user role is. So if you visit the website there, we have materials and training organized for individual learners who we're calling first detectors, and we have resources and training laid out for educators. Individual learners, some of the things that they're able to engage with, they are able to access the e-learning course. And in addition to the crop biosecurity course, we have specialty topic modules as well. And to support those individuals, we have different types of materials to support their online learning and training, things like diagnostic resources, supplemental materials that go with the course itself, and we've added new information on target pests. This is a screenshot of one of our e-learning modules. So again, individual learner resources, it's our online training modules. We've added recently information on target pests so that people can get the information on our website without having to just like click through individual modules. We've added more reporting and diagnostic lab contact information. We're partnering with Joe through EdMaps to make it easier for individuals to report directly through our website as well as on their phones. And we also have diagnostic resources to support that training. This is a screenshot of the website that just shows where you can find the target pests on our from our homepage. And what the way we've laid that out is these are organisms that are federally regulated. They are found somewhere in the United States. And they're sort of what we call our first detector target pests. So there might be other pests that you're concerned with in your state or region, but these are ones that have been recognized on the national or, you know, federal or regional level as significant pests. And the Asian longhorn beetle information page, this is just a screen capture. There's the option to, you know, read more about that, so people can learn why this pest, you know, why they should understand why this is a big deal, the hosts, how it moves around the country, how it was introduced, and then how you can report it right there. And, you know, another thing that we have with the individual pest pages is, you know, galleries, which is one of the things that Joe supports for us. We have galleries built into these individual pages so that people can actually click through and look at the organism, signs and symptoms on the plant. We have a big focus on plant symptoms, so it's not just the organism itself, but how to recognize when something might be unusual on their particular plant. For the educators, and you know, who are educators, first detector educators are first detectors themselves, and those people are going out and trying to recruit and train new first detectors. Examples of some of the educators in our program, when we originally launched the NPDN and the First Detector program, most of our educators were diagnosticians, as well as extension educators. Now we added to that Sentinel Plant Network garden educators and, you know, plant health care professionals. We have a lot of materials available for educators. We have workshop tools. So we have this online system where if you want to market or advertise your workshop, you can do so directly through our website, where you can register the workshop and people can sign up. Or you can just, you know, conduct the workshop and then upload the information later. We have all of our scripted PowerPoint presentations. Let's see. We have scripted PowerPoint presentations available for download that you can, like, edit or use in your programming. We have the crop biosecurity course, which includes things like the mission of the National Plant Diagnostic Network and the importance of plant biosecurity, how to submit samples to the National Plant Diagnostic Network and report pests, how to take photography for diagnosis so that you can report to your extension office or your diagnostic lab. And we also offer, you know, PDFs of those notes as well. Supporting diagnostic resources for both first detectors and first detector educators. These are all resources that are available for download on our website. We've got really nice, and some of these are through the Sentinel Plant Network. So this is a pest deck that was developed for the Sentinel Plant Network. Those are available for download on the Sentinel Plant Network website. But these are resources that, as an educator, you know, you can, you know, it's already done, you know, to use the words that Joe's used. We've already done the work for you, so it's just sort of a ready-made program off the shelf to just enhance or grow your outreach efforts. We have a series of taxonomic photo clues and signs and symptoms photo clues. So for more advanced people who have a little bit more of a background in entomology, we have things. We have a series that looks at certain target invasive pests and looks at them next to native species to just better help those people determine if it's something that is actually, you know, the threat or not. That's one on Asian longhorn beetle. But a lot of our first detector things, because, you know, those individuals come from varying backgrounds of knowledge in plant health or insect, you know, entomology and plant pathology. Our signs and symptoms photo clues really focus more on what people would see out in the field. We have sample submission checklists. Again, these were some resources developed for the Sentinel Plant Network to better help people determine when a pest or pathogen should be reported to one of our diagnostic labs. This is just a simple checklist that you can download. It's a PDF, and it asks you very simple questions like, this is for Asian longhorn beetle. You know, you have to write down what the host plant is, because if it's not one of the host plants for Asian longhorn beetle, there's a better chance that it's not, you know, Asian longhorn beetle. That may have not been the best example because there's a wide host range for that one, but you understand what I mean. We also have a suite of outreach and promotional resources. We have a first detector brochure. We have bookmarks and posters as well. So, again, just ways to get the information out there that invasive species, you know, are real and that they're moving around our communities, and to inform people and raise their knowledge of the issue and try to get them engaged. Some additional resources developed through the Sentinel Plant Network. We have some really nice training resources. We have something called the Emerging Threats Series. So keep in mind that people working in the Sentinel Plant Network, so member gardens, those are professionals. These are people working at public gardens. They're either frontline horticulturists or people working in IPM. So instead of just focusing with them on, like, you got to look for Asian longhorn beetle and sudden oak death and oak wilt, we've taken it to the next step, and we're focusing on a series of exotic pests, arthropods and diseases that are causing problems in other parts of the world, you know, in the event that they could potentially be introduced into the U.S. So these materials are available on the Sentinel Plant Network site, and they also have pest identification cards that go with them as well. The one in the image there is oak processionary moth, which is pretty nasty defoliator that's causing a lot of problems around Europe right now that causes respiratory and, like, dermatitis if you come in contact or even are near the pest. So it might not cause a lot of damage to the trees, but it poses a health risk and animal health risk as well. Another resource for Sentinel Plant Network, we have an outreach sign series. Now, these resources were developed for the Sentinel Plant Network by my team at Cornell. Okay. And again, just to raise importance about the importance, like early detection and the importance of, you know, finding things early, trying to raise support for quarantine programs by USDA. And these items are available for download on the Sentinel Plant Network site under outreach. And because of our role with the National Plant Diagnostic Network, that's why we made these resources available not only to the Sentinel Plant Network community, but to everybody. Oh, I just wanted to, I guess I was trying to show there, I forget these little animations, more ways in, on all of the outreach materials that we've developed for the Sentinel Plant Network. It highlights that the garden is actively participating in the First Detector program. So again, it's another way that like that community is further leveraging the First Detector program and the resources there, trying to just build that community and that network of people looking for invasive or introduced pests and pathogens. So just to wrap up, the First Detector program was a volunteer program that promotes the early detection of high consequence pests and pathogens. We have a variety of different materials, training, and diagnostic and outreach resources, both for the individual learner and the educator. And, you know, if this isn't something that you directly, if you're not doing public programming or outreach programming yourselves, you know, you can leverage other groups who are using these resources, you know, possibly try to link up with somebody, your local public garden, to, you know, promote First Detector and outreach in a venue that way. So with that, I think, connect with us on social media. And that's it. Thanks so much.
So we're going to, I guess, start our Q&A session, our discussion session. And I just remembered we're supposed to be talking to the microphone because they're recording this. I have a quick question for Rachel. So say if I wanted to work with Master Gardeners in my area to help them work with community gardeners to identify invasive spotted wing Drosophila in small fruit. How might I interact with, or how might I use resources from the National or the Plant First Detector Network that you just described?
That's a good question. So can you, is this on? Well, there's a different, can you just say the first part of that?
Yeah, so I work a lot with community gardens and consumer horticulture. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the gardeners don't know about these new invasive insect pests. And if I wanted to you know, start a project where I'm trying to get them to manage or, you know, just become aware of,
sure,
like,
okay,
a pest like spotted wing Drosophila, how
I was thinking of something else, but some of our states actually use our program and incorporate it directly into their master gardener requirements to become a master gardener. And people do it different ways. So depending on, you know, the diagnostician's appointment, if they have an extension component to their position, they might do face-to-face training and just use our crop biosecurity course. You know, they might create some of their own materials to, like, teach them about spotted wing Drosophila, but they'll, you know, teach them also, you know, the importance of why, you know, just the overview of the damage that invasive or introduced pests and pathogens cause, that sort of thing. Teach them how to report pests, teach them how to submit samples, introduce them to the resources that way. We have other people who say, you know, you need to complete the First Detector crop biosecurity course as part of your requirement to become a master gardener, do the online course, and then send me the certificate, bring in the certificate, and I check your name off. So, like, there's a couple of different ways that they can do that. I was wondering if you meant if you wanted them to be looking at samples and things like that. But it doesn't sound like
no.
It yet. Yeah. Okay.
Any other questions? Here we can.
That's really applicable to me, too, because I work with the same audience. But I have another question. That is, what's the connection between your, Rachel, your program and the State Department of Agriculture that are doing pest monitoring as well? For example, I'm from Oregon, and last year One of the things that ODA does monitor for is Japanese beetle. And I think they found about 17,000 Japanese beetles and traps in and around Portland International Airport last year. So it went from a few to quite a few in just 1 year. So it's out of curiosity, what's the interaction with those state departments of agriculture? Because, of course, they're doing the same sort of thing. They want to know as well.
Yeah, a lot of people are doing the same sort of thing. We definitely partner with the different Department of Agriculture labs. I think it's different from state to state. So in some instances, the State Department of Agriculture is actually one of the NPDN diagnostic labs. And, you know, they're definitely partners of ours. I do a lot of training, both First Detector training and the Sentinel Plant Network professional development training. And we always try to loop in and partner with or collaborate with people from the Department of Agriculture and, like, the regulatory people from APHIS. So for the First Detector program is funded. It started with NIFA, and now we've gotten some additional funds through APHIS to sort of expand the program. But whenever possible, we try to partner with and collaborate and not step on toes or, you know, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Well, and part of it, we've, in partnering with them on the mapping and other and the reporting via smartphone and all that, the State Departments of Agriculture are part of the verification network. So for regulated things in different states, it goes straight to them, and then they get to deal with it. So they are looped in several ways. You can't look at any of this without making sure the Department of Ag is aware. Otherwise, you're going to get a very nasty phone call one day.
Other questions? Herb, I have a question about some of the NIFA programs. So you had mentioned the SAS program, which is a new one. As a new kind of investigator, I'm really curious about how NIFA goes about prioritizing programs, how they come about. You know, some of them get transitioned out, and then new ones come in. So one of the ones that I'm thinking of, too, is the Higher Education Challenge, or not, maybe not that one, but the ELE, the AFRI, yeah. ELE program now becoming a service learning program, and how that really happens.
Yeah. Well, let me just tell you the process that's going on now. And I had a slide that, had I spoken longer, I could have gotten to it. This was important because it provides stakeholder input. So let's start at the beginning. So there's always the need, I think, in NIFA to create programs and have them run in a way that you have enough, people have enough familiarity with them, and you're not radically changing everything from year to year. There needs to be some sort of stability to the program. At the same time, you know, needs change, and you have to ask the question: Why do we fund this? Is it needed? And how do you transition from one to the other? So, a couple of things we've started doing is: well, one, we always listen to Congress because it wasn't clear from my talk, but we have one of the most complicated budgets in the federal government. We have individual lines from Congress that give us money, and that money can only be used in that line. We can't move money from one line to the other. So if it says the SARE program has this much money, that's how much SARE has, and that money is for SARE. So Congress is playing a large influence with talking to their stakeholders, their commodity groups. And I mentioned SARE because SARE, IR4, SCRI, you know, they have strong stakeholder groups that talk to Congress all the time. So that's one thing, because if Congress writes into the legislation, you will do this, well, then that sort of directs to a certain extent, you know, how that money's used. Second thing that NIFA has been doing, started last year, we've done it in the past in a different way, but this is much more organized. We started a thing called NIFA Listens, and there were 4 in-person listening sessions last year. We're going to do it again this fall. We haven't advertised any of the dates yet. And you could either go in person and put your input in, or you could go online and put your input in. And I was very interested when this was all done after going, they did it to four locations and the computers were open for a certain amount of time. Integrated pest management that I work with was mentioned in about 15%. It was in the top 10 of issues that were of concern to stakeholders. So any individual, some people have asked, well, who can get involved with this? Any individual can put information into NIFA Listens, or a society, or a university, or a department, or you know, any of the above. You don't. It's just, you know, it's very, very broad and open who can put comments in of what you think is important. So we're analyzing that information each year to say, well, what's being brought up by the stakeholders that may need to influence a certain RFA. We're also, we started last year, did it again this year for the second time. Early in the year, we're having an internal called NIFA Science Week. I've been at NIFA since 2000, and we've had staff meetings, and we've had lots, we have lots of team meetings, but this was an all science, everybody in the institution who had anything to do with science. We met for 3 days and had a couple 6 weeks leading up to it where you teams could gather to talk about topics that they felt from their sector, their stakeholders was important, or something that they knew from science, presentations on them, and then so Science Week information was captured. And some of the and so that NIFA Listens information, the information from Congress, NIFA Listens from the stakeholders, and then our own internal staff, there's, I think, much more robust conversations when we have what we call request for application writing teams who get together to write the RFAs, to actually put the content into the RFAs. So several of these were the result of, one, Congress increasing the AFRI appropriation, two, you know, some stakeholder input that we didn't really have a funding opportunity of that scale, and three, maybe the internal decision that we needed a kind of a challenging area for large grants. The ELI program, back to the education programs, that's just the name has changed. They're essentially, you know, the professional development for secondary school teachers, professionals, research and extension experiences for undergraduates, and the pre-doc and post-doc. That's really the old ELI, that whole section. There may be some little tweaks or nuances in there, and I think they were updated, but that whole opportunity still remains, just a name change, because they changed the AFRI RFA that goes out for that whole section to AFRI Education and Workforce. There has been more discussion in NIFA about how to educate workforce as opposed to students. That's kind of an evolving story, too. So, again, now AFRI has the three RFAs that are written by a whole host of people on different teams because, as you know, the foundational's got, you know, more than a dozen sub-programs that are each written by an individual team. So there's a lot of factors that go into what comes out at the end. And you also, we all forget, but, you know, we're sitting here waiting for the next year's budget to come out. But there's been work behind the scenes that the public never hears about on the budget for 2020. And so there's the president's budget has its own timeline. So you're executing a budget, you're getting ready for the next budget, and there's been work on the budget that's coming behind. So we think between NIFA Listen Science Week, you know, we have a much better way of hearing some things that need to get done and then actually being able to respond to those. So I would really encourage, I mean, I can't emphasize just how important that NIFA Listens is. I mean, you may seem like a trivial issue, but it was really significantly paid attention to. And we also got to hear from who in various sectors of what we do, who's really concerned about what. And so, again, it's one of those situations where you can say, well, I'll let somebody else put that in. Well, somebody else will. And they'll be heard and you won't. It's just that simple.
Any other questions for Herb, Rachel, Joe? I have lots of questions, so I could. Joe, I thought it was really. I didn't know that the IPM centers could help, or they helped collect citable data. So, for example, if I'm writing a crop protection and pest management proposal on, you know, the effects of Japanese beetle in the horticultural nursery industry or whatever. I know anecdotally by working with the farmers and working with the industry, but I don't have the numbers that are citable and that are easy to or that are convincing. And so, how do you or what resources do you look to gather that information?
So, things like pest management strategic plans. There's a conference held. Someone in that group decides to convene it, and they're. When they just did the tomato one in the southeast, I believe they had 180 people wrangled, put in the room, I think it was 2 or 3 days, and gathering perspectives not on what are the best practices, but what are you actually doing. Someone may put out an extension publication saying this is the way to do it, and the grower saying that doesn't work, and it's not cost effective. So, all right. Let's describe, it starts off with how the crop is grown, then goes to what are your pests, and then how they're being managed. And so it's a process, and that's why those get funded usually, I think, around $8,000, I think, is for a larger one, what they end up putting forward. And a lot of it's travel and organization time and getting the document together. For where we're asked to respond to questions, like if we get Office of Pest Management Policy or EPA calls and says we're trying to get a handle on what's going on right now with dicamba and injury showing up in fields, we reach out to all of our partners at the state land-grant universities. We have a regulatory science network, and we reach out and say, hey, here is the question we have been asked. Here is what we would like to know from you. We do that by email, and then when we don't get a response on that, because people are busy and it's field season, we call and try to get a quick synopsis that we can then roll up in time to get that out there. We will look at the pest management strategic plan, see if possibly it's already addressed, but in a bunch of cases, it's not. So we have to go to the specialists, occasionally out to the growers, but we mainly hit the specialists up because they have all the connections to the growers. So depends on the question that gets asked. The more things that become issues that keep coming up, the more we look at, is there any way we can collect this data uniformly that we have that answer when the question gets asked 4 or 5 times in the next, you know, several months. And when we're lucky, we get something that works for that. We don't always have it.